This week in Retronauts, it is the business of the future to be dangerous. Hi everyone, welcome back to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and we are resuming a conversation from like a month-ish ago, but there's a surprise this time, which is that we brought in another person to help talk about stuff. So this is episode 529, according to my notes, and our last episode in which we discussed this topic, which we'll get to in a moment after I finish my preamble, is 523, which was a patron-only episode. Oh, just like this one. So if you're a patron, good news. You get to hear a lot about Super Metroid. If you're not a patron, you need to go and subscribe to our podcast for $5 a month or more, and then you can hear a lot about Super Metroid. As with our previous episode, we consist of myself, Diamond Fight, and Stuart Jip, but also there's a little newcomer here in the mix. I can't even think of a good Super Metroid reference here to add. So please introduce yourself, random space marine who has joined us midway through the journey.
I'm Nadia Oxford. I'd say I'm more like an Etacoon in that I jump up things and piss people off.
Do you jump up things?
No, not anymore.
I've never seen you do a wall jump. Not once in all the years that I've known you.
No. For as long as I've known that wall jumps exist, I've tried to do them, and I've never succeeded even once.
Have you tried doing like the Ninja Gaiden thing where you stick to the wall first and then spring off?
Or I'm sure
do you
if
always
I can...
just do like the, you know, the Batman Samus thing where you just triangle jump?
I'm sure I can manage if I learn how to do that flip and like, you know, not just like the straight jump for jabronis. I mean, like the real stuff.
Right.
I picture Nadia as more of a Mega Man X style, just slowly sliding down the vertical surface.
Yeah, the fact that you called it the triangle kick, you told on yourself there, Parrish.
Oh my God, did I? What is that? What is that
a
reference to?
It is very much a reference to Mega Man X, but from the manga by Iwamoto.
I thought that was a reference to Strider for NES.
Oh, okay. Capcom, you're doing stuff behind our backs.
I know, they're slipping around. Anyway, we've heard the other people, I've already introduced them, but please give us your names in your own voices so that people listening who somehow are subscribed to the show and have never heard your voices can say, oh yes, that is the voice of this person.
Well, my name is Diamond Fight, and I'm here to ask the hard questions. Namely, what the hell is a Zebatite, really? What is it?
That's a good question.
It's a little Zebat.
I don't know.
That's the
mystery tube.
Diminutive construction.
It's a mystery tube. You shoot it, but then it grows back again. I don't get it. Are they evil? Are they just in the way? I don't know. I don't trust them.
Yes.
I think they're just small Zebats, and so it does. The name Zebatite does presuppose the existence of a large Zebat someplace, and I guess maybe that's going to be the final boss of the franchise. All right. Anyway, also the other person here.
Hello, I'm Stuart Jip, and oh well, we've only got 1 minute to escape the podcast. Everybody run!
Oh no, those platforms are too small. I'm slipping.
Oh no, I failed. I'm not playing this again.
That's why you don't do the flip jump when you're trying to escape, Nadia. You have to know when to hold them and know when to flip them.
Incidentally,
that's so cool.
If you have big feet, and I'm not saying that I want to know if you do or not, you should do the wall jump from Tiny Toon Adventures, Buster's Hidden Treasure, on the Sega Mega Drive, where Buster uses his massive feet to propel him off a wall. And they stole that. Super Metroid stole it from the Tiny Toons game, and I will never be convinced otherwise.
I love the original Tiny Toons, but I never played the follow-ups.
I'm glad, Stu, that you're keeping Nintendo honest here by just recounting every single thing that the game has stolen from other games. I appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. I mean, Super Metroid, if nothing else, is derivative to a fault, so we will be discussing
it's
that, of course.
It's just pilfering and theft from one end to the other.
Yeah, more like super steel stuff, I don't know.
Super Met Steel.
Nice.
Samus was the original Tomb Raider.
Oh. Nice.
Raiding the tombs of our heart.
I like that.
Anyway, let's recap the last episode, because Nadia wasn't here, but hopefully Nadia has listened to the last episode, so she's not coming into this as unprepared as I am.
Sure.
Okay, that's promising. Excellent. So Super Metroid was a game that Nintendo created nearly 30 years ago. Wow. And the premise of this two-part episode is, one, Super Metroid kicked ass, and we've never really dedicated a single episode to it. So now we're dedicating two episodes to it. But also, Super Metroid, for all of its derivative properties that we've just discussed, was also highly influential. Actually, talking straight here, it was much more influential than derivative, and
yes,
has kind of become the basis, the foundation of an entire subgenre of games. I mean, at this point, it's pretty much a genre. It's the Metroidvania, or the Mapsplorer, or Castleroid, or whatever dumb name that's not as good as Metroidvania you want to apply to it. It's fine. There are dozens, hundreds of games designed around the concepts and structures of Super Metroid. And so what we're talking about here, in addition to just saying, hey, Super Metroid, that game was cool and great, is what have other games taken from Super Metroid? How, you know, how do you find these elements in subsequent works? You know, the Metroidvania really exploded, I would say, about 15 years ago, when indie developers said, you know what, I grew up playing Metroid and it was cool and there's not enough of these games out there, so I'm going to make my own. And now every indie developer is making a Metroidvania, so it's not so much of a, like, you know, I'm filling a void, you know, a vacuum in the video games industry, so much as this is now my rite of passage. And that's great. So we're going to talk about where they came from. But Nadia, we need to know, where did you first encounter Super Metroid? I think we all told our stories last episode, but you were not here, so we need to know, at what point did you first play Super Metroid and say, this is the greatest thing ever and every game is going to rip it off?
First of all, anyone who says Castleroid is a cop. Who says Castleroid?
People oh my God. Who have no self-awareness. It's
terrible.
If
someone said that to me, I would hit them. Ridiculous.
I would be like, go get yourself a topical ointment, talk to your proctologist, come back and see me in a few weeks.
If you have a Castleroid, man, you don't want to sit down. You probably can't sit down ever.
You said castle, right? Castle, right? Not asshole.
Yeah, yes, okay, castle. Castleroid. But it's a roid the size of a castle. So you need Simon to get in there and be Dracula.
Yeah,
so
you,
it collapses.
You need a special pillow that's slightly bigger
than a
castle.
He's going to prolapse it for you.
Oh,
you have
Jesus.
To, collect.
What the hell's going on?
What's happening?
I didn't agree to this podcast.
He's going
to
get that whip. And anyway, so,
you know, people,
yes,
get,
please,
people, get, people get mad at me for talking about SodaStream. Now we're talking about prolapsed anuses.
No. Castleroids. Prolapsed castleroids. This is okay, totally totally different. I don't know what you're talking about, Stuart.
Not anuses. Okay, I apologize. I got the wrong end of the stick there.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the topic of anuses.
I just can't stop thinking about anuses, man. All right, moving on.
I actually didn't play Super Metroid until I got married. So that was sometime around 2001, I would say, was when I actually first played Super Metroid, because my husband and I, we combined our game collections. He had Super Metroid, I did not, because I was spending all my money on RPGs. So that's when I first played Super Metroid, and I really liked it, because, of course, we were married, we had no money, so I went back and played all the old games, never really played. And the thing is, I got really into Symphony of the Night long before I actually played Super Metroid for the first time. So, of course, I was like, this game is great. It's just like Symphony of the Night. And
this game's a big ripoff.
What the? No, I didn't say that, at least. I wasn't that ignorant. No, but I knew of Metroid, of course, because I was like reading GamePro and stuff. And I have actually the issue of GamePro where they preview Super Metroid, and I was like, oh, that looks really cool, but I'm going to buy Star Fox instead, and I did, which,
that's,
you know,
not an RPG, come on.
No, that's true, but it does have the Super FX chip, and
that's true.
Really good at the original Star Fox, but yeah, I came in pretty late, but I realized a good game when a good game is a good game, and although I did nearly get soft-locked around the point where you're supposed to do that stupid wall jump, which is why I was cursing the Etacoons earlier. Because you can save and make it so that you can't get out of that pit unless you learn how to wall jump. So that's really like John Wayne throwing you in the water to learn how to swim bullshit right there.
Can I interject with something?
Of course.
I'm not trying to be like, oh, you know, get good, that sort of thing. That's not that is exactly how I feel, but I'm not trying to say that. Look, the thing is,
he's being more tactful.
I think that the wall jump is really easy to do. Like, I'm not saying that, like, oh, idiot. For me, it seems so simple to do. But there are moves in other games that I find next to impossible that everyone else seems to find easy. So obviously it's a either each to their own. But it's always weird to me because it just seems so, what's the word? Intuitive?
Yeah. It doesn't feel that way to me at all.
Yeah, going back to the NES Strider that I mentioned before, which, by the way, I checked, and that is where the term comes from.
Oh,
the triangle jump in that game, the wall jump, was absolute garbage. Like, it's just hot
just
trash.
Just like the rest of it.
Burn. Yes, exactly. I don't know what happened there. But, you know, after having figured that out, the Super Metroid wall jump was pretty easy for me. But I could see where people coming from having played good games might
like
be
Mega Man
little,
X.
Yeah, exactly. It might be a little more put off.
It requires a very specific timing. Like the game is very rigid about this, and it's like once you get used to it, I think you can get in the groove. But if you're not used to it, or if you're used to other games that have a different rhythm, I think it throws you. And indeed, today I was watching a young person stream this game, which apparently is my hobby now. I watch young people play old games and just remark at how they experience them. But this streamer, who is obviously a very experienced gamer, he was like, what's with this wall jump? So he was a little vexed by it too. So it's like once, you know, if you're not used to it, it can throw you. So yeah, when you're trapped down there, I know definitely both that one and the Shine Spark thing. Like when I got stuck in both those areas, it took me a little bit of frustration and repetition of like, what the hell is this? What the hell is this? And if, you know, I eventually escaped. Don't worry. I beat this game. I have proof I beat the game, but.
Proof.
I could see how both situations.
Professor Oak gave them a certificate.
So okay.
Congratulations, Diamond. You killed all 151 of the Pokemon by blowing up the planet. It was very touching.
That'd be a really cool game.
I rescued the animals. I did. I rescued them. I swear.
The weird thing about the wall jump, the thing that I feel gets people hung up, and this was my problem for a while when I first was trying to master it, is that it's not just about jumping toward the wall and then kicking off by jumping again. You have to jump and press away from the wall at the same moment.
Yes.
Once you get that, like once you figure that out, which is not really explained that well in the game, once you figure that out, then it's pretty easy to pull off consistently, and you can, you know, do yourself a little wall jump pinball all the way up, and that's where they got the idea for Metroid Prime pinball.
So you had an NES Strider with a triangle jump, right?
Yes.
I had Master System Strider 2. Who had the worst time?
Probably you, actually.
Yeah,
I mean, for all of its flaws, Strider for NES was developed by Capcom, as opposed to, was it Tier-Tex?
Yes,
Strider
it was Tier-Tex. Yeah.
Well, there you go. So, yeah, you know, Strider for NES is a mess, but it's a mess with big ideas, and you have to respect that.
I do respect that.
It's based on a comic that never came to America. Who couldn't love that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, the comic only came out in Japan, but the game only came out in America. So
oh, that
this,
makes
there
sense.
Was, this is totally off topic, but there was this whole, like, cross-media strategy. They were going to turn Strider into a franchise, and they just absolutely whiffed it. Just,
he's not even in any Capcom games as a cameo.
Like he disappeared forever.
If it's not been done already, I'll do a Strider episode, and then we can get all of this Strider done.
We've actually done a Strider episode. Sorry,
done.
But you could come up with some excuse to do something, you know, intersectional.
British, terrible British sequels to Japanese games.
Yes. Oh my God, that's a great idea.
Fantastic.
We did not really talk about Strider 2 or the Master System version of Strider 1. So you could talk
imagine if Super Metroid had been developed by Britain. It would have been awful. It would just been unimaginably awful.
No comment. But it would have been isometric, so you know there's some charm to that. A little chubby Samus isometric sprite moving around.
Yeah.
Look like what's the name of the jetpack guy?
Jetpack? I don't know.
Willie?
Jet Willie.
Jet Set Willie. Well, yeah. I mean that's not his name. That's an amalgamation of Jet Set Willie and Jetpack. But
know.
You know, go
the
off
ultimate
by
crossover.
All means.
Well,
go
he has
off.
A name
the ultimate
now,
crossover.
What I'm saying.
You guys don't know about the difference between Jetpack and Jet Set Willie.
I'm afraid I do, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
I don't take any pride in that. Anyway, why don't we talk about Super Metroid? Yeah. So sure. We talked about a lot of stuff. We were kind of all over the place in the previous episode. But in terms of the notes that I laid out, which are 14 pages long, we only got to page, what, 3? My God.
Gracious.
So with this episode, we're going to, assuming we ever actually talk about Super Metroid, take a more granular approach and more structured approach and talk about specific game components and, one, how they work or don't work in some cases, maybe, I don't know, and also just how those ideas have gone on to affect and influence other games in subsequent years. How does that sound? It sounds great, right?
You know what? That absolutely. Sounds, that sounds sure. Absolutely fantastic, Jeremy. I'm really looking forward
to it. You say it sounds cracking?
Yeah, cracking.
More corking.
It sounds absolutely, yeah. It sounds like a whizzer
wow.
thing to do.
Sweet. Yeah. Okay, phenomenal. This is like Super Metroid was designed by the British. All right, so we're going to begin with backtracking. That is a thing you do in Super Metroid. And we talked about this a little bit in the previous episode, or maybe a lot, about how basically the game requires you to do a certain amount of backtracking, but it's not just like setting you loose to explore a vast map that you've already covered in search of one or two little tiny objects. It's very good about, one, about kind of limiting the amount of backtracking you can do until it's ready to take off the training wheels in very subtle ways. And two, it's really good about kind of giving you little hints of things that might intrigue you and make you say, oh, I need to go back to that. Those are two really strong design components of Super Metroid. And, you know, it's not the game that invented those concepts, but, you know, I think back to the nonlinear games on NES and other 8-bit systems that I've played, and you just don't really see that kind of breadcrumb trail approach. It really, you know, the idea of, like, here is a ledge that is just out of reach. You can't jump up there no matter how hard you try. You didn't really see a lot of that in games, unless it was more like, you know, like a linear action game where the idea was, oh, maybe you take a different path through the stage this time, but, you know, there's no sense of backtracking because you complete the stage and you're done, so you just need to figure out how to get to that other part. Like, you know, Super Mario Land is a good example of that.
Mm. Yeah.
Where you have, you know, kind of like the obvious course through each stage, but then a lot of times you'll see, you know, coins hidden beneath the floor and there's no way to get there. You know, or coins way up above in the ceiling or something. And it's just not physically possible for Mario to get there, no matter how hard you try. And so it sticks with you and it intrigues you. And you say, you know, I want to get those coins because Mario is a greedy little bastard and he needs all of his coins. And you have to figure out how to get them, which usually involves going down a pipe or something at some point. Mm. But it's that same principle applied to Super Metroid and its nonlinear world, you know, the kind of open, non-goal-based style of map design.
Yeah.
And it's very, very enticing and effective because you see stuff and you're like, God dang, why can't I get that E-tank? I want it now, but I can't have it.
It's also a confidence that none of the other Metroid games have matched. Like every single other one that I can think of has some measure of this is where you need to go next. Infusion, the absolute direct hand-holding.
Yeah.
And Zero Mission, the Chozo statues that will show you your next destination. I mean, yes, you are still exploring to find out how to get there, but it's really not, in my opinion, on the same level. It's just so much more confident in Super Metroid. They know they've made this world that, while it has its intricacies and it's like, what's the word? It's traps and it's like tricks. It's still navigable and they know that it is. And I dig that a lot. I appreciate the confidence of that coming out of the gate, just knowing that your map is that good, basically. Oh no, I killed the conversation again.
Oh my God. Yep. I was waiting for Diamond to jump in with their correction that they put in the notes.
Oh, well, it's, I can do that now. Sure. We talked a lot about the map last episode, a lot about the map, and we all agree, you know, map good. But in praising Super Metroid's map, we indeed, in fact, gave it too much credit because there is, in fact, no doors on the Super Metroid map. We all remember it because We think, you know what it is? We're thinking of fusion. Starting with fusion,
there's the map doors everywhere on the map fight. There's doors everywhere.
I mean, the little map, about? The map that, like the mini map thing, not the actual game map.
I'm sorry. I thought you'd gone crazy.
I mean, like, actual, the geometry based, just sort of like, you know, simple, it has the lines, it shows all the rooms connecting. It has that nice border thing that Jeremy talked about, where it's like, if you don't fill out the room all the way, you won't see the border. But ultimately, these blocks all just fit together, and there is no indication of doorways at all. So, but, yeah, Fusion has doors. Symphony Knight has little holes to show where doorways are. Yeah. But Super Metroid, no holes.
No holes for Super Metroid. How does it? Never mind.
Don't the lines in each at the end of each block indicate doors, given that there's not going to be anything else there? I mean, it's all doors. You only travel through doors or gaps, so... Don't the white lines that mark each side of each map piece essentially mark the doors? Or do you mean like the color specifically of what door you're going to be encountering? Let's make the whole contest. The whole podcast should be this argument, I think.
Should be this door.
I'll explain. Every room, you know, every room in Super Metroid has a sort of defined outline to it. So if two rooms connect to each other and they only connect once, then you can judge, oh, this must be a doorway. But if the rooms don't connect at all, it looks the same on the map. So you might go somewhere, it's like, oh, this connects to this room, right? And you get there, and it's like, oh, no, there's no door. You can't.
Okay, yeah, there's some place like that I believe, Ridley's Lair, where it looks like, you look at the map and you're like, oh, cool, this is, you know, like a passage. And then you get there, and no, it's actually just two dead ends that butt up against each other, and there is actually no way to get through.
Yes, Mop did have some.
And then you waste time, and you don't get the best ending. And Samus is sad because she doesn't get to wear her swimsuit and go swimming.
Aw, that's so mean.
Oh, Samus. Mm-hmm.
I actually found the map to be a little confusing by the time you get to, what is it, Meridia? Is it that what it's called? The
Yes.
Yeah, the the watery grave of every gameplay.
I think maybe that's because it's just such a weird all-over-the-place area, but probably haven't talked about that area yet, have we?
A little bit.
We kind of jumped all over last episode. Yep. So, you know, there's going to be some repetition, but your presence here brings a new perspective on things. So please,
there
by
you
all
go.
Means.
That's what I'm here for. I have to say, though, maybe the part of the reason for my confusion is you have that little sequence where you're going way, way down the pipes. And, you know, kudos to the team. This is where you first see your Metroids, your quote-unquote Metroids, your Mock-Droids. And that's a bit of a heart-stopping moment, to be honest. But I remember getting very lost and very angry at that particular sequence of the game. And everything else was fantastic, but to me, things just really slowed down there.
Yeah, Meridia is, I think, the point where the game does open up a lot. It has, you know, Meridia itself has basically two sections that are very different from one another.
Right, yes.
And there's a lot of interchanges between them and a lot of large open spaces that you just kind of have to navigate. And, you know, some kind of non-obvious ways to advance, like that one room where it has the grappling points and then the path forward is up in the ceiling. And... you know, you can look around and wonder, where the hell am I supposed to go, until you realize, oh, there's a ceiling hatch up there that I'm supposed to travel through. So it is the point where the game kind of expects you to figure it out. It's like, you know, you've come this far, go for it. This is where it really kind of stops being gated to progression so much and kind of, you know, using barriers, organic barriers to sort of guide you through the proper play. And
but it's
at
also,
this point, it's like the midpoint, and it's like, okay, the rest of it, it's just kind of you got to figure it out.
It's also literally slow until you get the gravity suit, though.
Right.
That's
right.
Part of what probably frustrated me.
Yeah, but even once you get that suit, though, I must say, Meridia is one of the most annoying zones because there's so much quicksand, and there are places where you can basically fall down to a lower level, and you have to climb all the way back up, and like you have to like go back around things, and... During my recent replay of the game, I definitely was getting a little irritated at that point because I don't know the enemy names, I'm sorry, but those kind of chubby little things that shoot like spikes at you, and they all hang out in the boss room eventually when you fight the boss. Like the boss is essentially a big version of these little fat things.
Those things. Yeah.
Those things, they appear. You can't actually destroy them. You can freeze them, but they sort of hover in places, and they're in a lot of the quicksand rooms. So if you bump into them and you fall in the sand, you got to mash the jump button to get out, or otherwise you might sink down and then you're stuck in there and you're just,
Yeah,
those things are, I believe the term is hella annoying.
But the thing you eventually realize is that you don't need to spend a lot of time in the quicksand rooms. Those are almost kind of like a distraction. It's kind of an annoying distraction for sure. But you really just need to kind of pass through them once or twice, and then you're done with it, which is, which is good. But Meridia does have a lot of kind of dead end spaces and just rambling areas where you might find, an item or something, but otherwise it's not the critical path. And
some of the items in Meridia are very well hidden, and you have to like go out of your way. Or maybe you have to fall down like a one-way chute and not miss any blocks, and then you can get an item. But if you do miss something, then you got to, again, climb back up and do it again. So I think I probably miss a lot of stuff in Meridia just because I can't be bothered to get it.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's fine. And it also has the trickiest item to acquire in the entire game. There is one missile, I believe, that
Shine Spark.
You have to Shine Spark, and you have to do it through a really kind of frustrating room. So I've tried it a few times, and it's always a big pain in the ass. And then, there's all kinds of puzzles in the later Metroid games that are specifically designed around that concept, and that is why I never go for 100%. But
I've never got a good rank in a Metroid game because I simply don't want to.
The fun is
in finishing them. I don't care. I don't like bombing every block trying to find where these items are, and it's not fun. So I just get enough items to get by, and that's about it.
I kind of agree with that, and the reason why is because, say, with something like Symphony of the Night, I'm much more obligated, or feel much more obligated, to get as much as I can. But with something like Super Metroid, that's not really how you get the power-ups the way you do in some other Metroidvania-style games. It just feels like it's more worth it to explore every nook and cranny versus, oh boy, more missiles. I don't really need this, but thank you.
Yeah, well, then you get up against Ridley, and you're like, oh god, I wish I had more missiles.
That's true, but I usually have enough.
Okay, fair enough. The thing about Meridia is that it is kind of annoying, but the longer I spend with this game, the more I kind of see all the little ideas and subtleties that the development team built into it. And the whole thing about the underground mazes in Zebes is that it's clearly, like people have constructed this, whether it was the Space Pirates or the Chozo many millennia before, whatever. It's clearly designed to be a usable space, but you get into Meridia and only portions of that are built out. And a lot of Meridia seems like it's basically still unclaimed land, like just natural formations that just happen to have conduits, doors connecting them. But it seems like this was very much it's the real estate project in progress, but then the housing market collapsed, so the Chozo never got around to properly, developing it. So you have, like the lab area with the mock droids, and that's very interesting. But then the rest of it is mostly just raw, unfinished space. And the fact that there are these kind of, aimless passages and seemingly superfluous spaces actually, maybe in gameplay terms, it's not the best, but in terms of, like the game spaces as narrative components, I think it actually works really well because it does say like, oh, you've really kind of entered the wilds here. You're in the weeds. And yeah, I appreciate the fact that there is this kind of consideration given to how the game world unfolds in terms of the story. And also, Meridia is not a space that's in the original Metroid, which so much of Super Metroid's map is based on. So when you get there, it is, I've entered a space that I don't know before. So if you're coming in as someone who knows the original Metroid and is familiar, at least in the broad strokes with the passages you've been exploring to this point, it does give you this sense of like, whoa, what is all of this? This is totally new. And, some of the areas of Lower Brinstar also have that, but this is much more a sense of like, this is entirely new. I don't know what to do here. And I feel a little bit lost. So Yeah, like I'm thinking back, you know, many, many years to when I first played this game. And I do remember, as someone who basically had committed the original Metroid's map to memory at that point, having played it so many times, Meridia did feel like, you know, this is where things are kind of getting real, because I don't know any of this. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. This is all new.
I have to ask something about the original Metroid, because I don't have perspective for this. That game here in the UK, like, I only heard of Super Metroid. I'd never heard, like, I didn't even know there was a Metroid. So in the States, the original Metroid, was that actually like an avowed, like, this is, everyone's playing this, this is great, this is a bit, this is one of the big games?
No, not in my childhood anyway.
Right. You're not in the States, Nadia. Come on.
If it wasn't hockey, I guess. If it was hockey in Metroid, for sure. But no, there wasn't.
I thought it had a pretty good reputation. It's a game that I saw other friends play, and I think that was, it wasn't a black box. Was it the gray box? It was like an
It was
early
a silver box, which was a black box, but silver.
Right.
Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, I have an issue of Total, which was one of the more preeminent Nintendo magazines that reviewed the original Metroid, and I think they gave it something like 50. And they're just really, really boring.
Well, by the time it came out in the UK, it may have been, like, extremely dated. So, my memories of the original Metroid stem from, like, early 1988. So about, you know, half a year after it first came out. And I knew a lot of people who owned the game. They talked about it at school and at church, you know. Like, everyone was sharing tips and talking about the mini-bosses and how scary the Metroids themselves are and how you have to use special techniques to beat them.
Right.
So there was a lot of discussion. And, you know, Metroid did see a reprint. There were
four
games that were reprinted in new packaging when the mini NES launched, the redesigned AV Famicom version of the NES. And those were Zelda, Zelda 2, Punch-Out, which, you know, had to be redesigned for certain logistical legal reasons, and Metroid. So Metroid, yes, it was a big deal in the US for whatever reason.
Right. I don't mean to imply, like, it sucks, it shouldn't have been popular. I genuinely didn't know. Like, I didn't know I had this reputation. Because it seems like this and Metroid 2, sorry, the original and Metroid 2, to me, from my perspective, seem quite alienatingly difficult games that are full of big open spaces in which not a whole lot happens. And that doesn't strike me as a recipe for huge hit, basically.
Yeah, I don't know. Metroid just connected with people. It came out within a month of Zelda in the US. And I think kids were just kind of like, oh, cool. It's stuff to do. Like, this game can keep me busy for, you know, months and months.
Cool, it's alien.
Yes. So, yeah, like, for whatever reason, Metroid was a big hit in the US and not really anywhere else, as far as I'm aware. And Metroid 2, yeah, that came later. And I don't know if it was as big a hit, but it did sell very well on Game Boy, because it had
a great commercial.
I did know a lot of people who had that one.
Well, it had a greatest hits reissue.
Right.
And they talked about doing a color version of it, which for Game Boy Color, which they never did.
Oh, that's a shame.
But yeah, so Super Metroid, I feel, was kind of the global breakout for this series. But even I don't know, like, you can buy the Japanese version of Super Metroid super cheap still, whereas the American version, good lord.
Yeah, good luck with
is
that.
Is it an expensive one?
Yes, everything's expensive on Super NES now. Any first-party game is just going to set you back.
Everything is expensive on every format. The whole market is completely fucked.
that's a whole other conversation.
I'm sorry, but like, this is absurd to me, but like, I can't buy a copy of, say, I'm going to say it again, Era of the Acrobat, unboxed, just the disc, the cartridge, is like £80. It's not even good or rare. Like, come on.
Oh, I think that's got the Sunsoft tax.
Yes, it does.
Love Sunsoft.
Okay, yeah, that might explain it. Well,
and Americans
so
don't care, because we never got all the good games. It's really sad.
If anyone who's listening wants to hook me up, hook me up.
We've talked a lot about the map of Super Metroid and how cool it is and how big and how you have to kind of find your way around and some of the techniques that the game uses to sort of guide you. But one of the really important factors there is that it integrates tutorials into the design. And we talked about this a little bit last time, but not in a specific way. But I think, you know, one of the reasons that Nintendo was able to, you know, the R&D one team was able to kind of set players loose and just give them this big space. One is because they said, oh, let's put a map in here now. That seems like a good idea. But also because the game is constantly teaching you how to use tools and techniques all the way up through the end. When you get the space jump, you have to like use the space jump to get out of that room.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, there's two kinds of tutorials. There's the, you just got an item. Now you have to use that item to get out of this room or it's a soft lock. And then there are the overt tutorials where you fall into a weird pit and you have to listen to these little animals who will, you know, pantomime for you the way to escape and figure that out.
And they will chatter endlessly.
They sure do. That's extra motivation to figure it out and get the hell out of there.
You little bastards, I'm leaving. Well, she does kind of pick up a bunch of them at the end of Metroid Fusion, so.
Yeah, the manual, you know, does outline a lot of the tools and abilities in more detail. But if you're just playing the game, I feel like it does, you know, with almost unspoken words, it really does communicate really well.
Yeah.
How to use every new thing you find. Because if you think back to, you know, going back to the original Metroid, if you found a new item, you get nothing. Like, you mm-hmm. learn nothing. There's not even an instruction of what to do with it. It's just like, you know, Faria, okay? Is this a cheesecake? Like, what am I supposed to do with this thing? Whereas in this, you know, in this new game, most new items, you either get a little, you know, you either get a little blurb of text, like the bomb, like, shows you what you're supposed to do with the bomb, or the game literally, like, you're in a room, it's like, okay, you just got a thing, you're going to use it right now, otherwise this game is over, you know?
Right.
Some of the advanced stuff is in the attract mode as well, right? Like, if you could just leave it on mm-hmm. the top of the screen, you'll see some of the special moves.
Oh, that's
wild, because in that attract mode, there's even stuff in there that's not anywhere else, which is kind of really mind-blowing. There's stuff in there that the game doesn't even tell you about, unless you just let the game play on the title screen, and then it will show you some weird stuff that you
learn. Yeah, like that's how you do the bomb heal,
the
right?
Crystal Flash.
Crystal Flash.
Crystal Flash, yep. That's it. Yeah.
Which they even named a gas station chain for that move. You have to let the attract mode run for a long time to see that. And I don't know anyone who would just be like, well, I've got a cool Metroid game. I'm just going to sit here and watch the title screen cycle over and over.
Yeah.
So it's the kind of thing that, for me personally, I didn't know about this stuff until I was at the mall and I walked past a Walden Software or something that had Super Metroid on display. And I was like, whoa, I've never seen some of this attract mode stuff before. And I started watching it out of curiosity. And then I see Samus like curl into a, you know, like a fetal position and explode into a ball of light. And I'm like, what in God's name is this? This is amazing. Yeah. This is the game? I've beaten this game like 5 times. What's going on here? So yeah, it's super hidden, even though it's right there in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's cool. I really like stuff like that. This, you could go years and never see that. Like,
oh man, I miss attract modes like that.
Oh hell yeah.
That's a lost art right there. I remember the CompuCenter in Toronto had, one of them had a attract mode for Wild Arms, which was a great idea for an attract mode game.
So yeah, the game gives you tutorials, and then at the end, I think one of the single most influential and important things that Super Metroid does is to rate you not only on the time it takes to complete the game, which the first game did and the second game did, but in the original Metroid, it wasn't displayed. It was just the longer you took to complete the game, the less you saw of Samus's, you know, actual identity. But actually, did Metroid 2 give you a percentage of items found? I don't think it did.
I think it might have. I'm just seeing it in my mind.
Now that I'm saying this, I feel like I'm about to speak out of turn. But
I'm here to make you second guess everything.
Regardless of whether or not Metroid 2 did this, Super Metroid did it, and it was just a great influential idea, which is to, at the end of the adventure, say, you took this long to complete the game, and you found this percentage of the items within the game. And okay, now I'm thinking, did Zelda A Link to the Past do this too?
Sorry, I'm not sure if it came before this or after, but Donkey Kong Country did it.
Donkey Kong Country was about 6 months after Super Metroid.
Oh, really? Okay, well, then never mind. The monkeys ripped it off once again.
Sorry, yes, of course. Those freaking monkeys, man.
Bloody monkeys.
Yeah. I believe Metroid 2 only has a time. I don't think it has a percentage. I think it just has time.
Okay.
Okay. But the point is, it gives you incentive to go back and replay the game and to, you know, to kind of test your mettle and really to create new metrics and objectives for yourself. Like, how fast can I beat this game and how much can I find in that time? And for a game that doesn't have a score and doesn't have, you know, a timer on it, you know, in terms of like actually finish the gameplay, there's no real way to include Super Metroid in a, you know, like a high score rating, you know, ranking board like Nintendo Power had. And, you know, having these extra metrics in there gives you the ability to not only test yourself, but to test yourself against other people. And that's become such an integral part of things like games done quick, and speedrunning. I mean, really, you look back to the origins of speedrunning 20 years ago, and Super Metroid was, it was a factor in there for sure. And the idea was just like time versus percentage, which is brilliant.
Yeah,
it's when I think of games that it makes me think back to. I know it's not Nintendo, but it makes me think back to Sonic CD, which tracked your time across every single stage and then gave you a global time, so to speak, and it encouraged like unlockables for getting your time to below certain thresholds, which I always thought was quite nice. Not dissimilar. The only other thing I could think of in terms of Nintendo and percentages was Kirby's Adventure, which definitely has some kind of ranking system as well. But that's one of the many ways in which Kirby and Samus are basically exactly the same.
They are. I just looked it up. Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past only tracked the number of restarts that you made. Like,
oh,
the number
of times I
you died
how that
and
worked.
Restarted the game.
Yeah.
Per dungeon.
Link's Awakening had a bonus for not dying ever. There was like a little extra bit that happened if you didn't ever die. But you could cheat it by just resetting every time you died. Because screw that.
So something that that really sort of complicates the task of getting 100% item completion is the fact that there are some elements, some items to collect that I touched on one of them before in Meridia that require a higher level of skill to collect. You know, for the most part in Super Metroid, you know, a lot of items are just out there. It's just sitting there, and you know, the key items that you need to progress, you have to collect them in order to make your way through the game. And so there are no surprises there. No, like, well, how come I didn't find the various suit that I need to get into the superheated areas? Where is that? And like, it's you're going to find it. But then there are things that are hidden, and you can only find them by bombing or using a super bomb or finding them with the X-ray scanner. And then there are items that are maybe, you know, fairly visible, but they require special techniques to acquire. Some of them, you know, you have to like actually go to a different section of the game and then backtrack around through hidden passages to find, like, you know, roll around in little conduits that only Samus can only fit through in her morph ball form. So there's a lot of that, kind of the extra, you know, 10% of the game, 10% of the collectibles that you really have to put in an effort to find. And, you know, that's something that I think has also become integral to the Metroidvania format.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's an energy tank in the ceiling of Brinstar, which you would know about it if you played the first Metroid, but if you didn't play the first Metroid or you forgot about it, there's really no reason you would think to look up there. You know, it's an undescript part of the ceiling. There's also several items I'm thinking of where it's like, you go through a secret and you find an upgrade, but then you have to blow up the wall behind this upgrade and you get another upgrade. Mm-hmm. Like some of them are like double layered on that one. I know mm-hmm. there's one, I believe, in Kraid's Lair where it's like you need to go in there with a super bomb, which you do not get until way later in the game. So it's like mm-hmm. you have to make a choice to go back to Kraid's Lair for no reason other than I wonder if I missed something. And it's like, yes, you did miss something because you couldn't have possibly found this without the power bomb.
Yeah, I do enjoy the places where it's like, oh, I found something, but then you have to keep digging. There's a lot of that right around kind of the starting point of the game, you know, where the original Metroid began. Like, that whole area is just, every time you go there and start digging, you find more and more stuff. And then you dig so far that you end up exposing yourself to these, like, super high-level enemies that definitely did not appear there in the original Metroid. You were like, oh, this is what's behind the wall where the first game ended. Good thing I didn't accidentally blow that open when I was baby Samus and only had 30 health, because that would have been the end of the game.
Yeah, there's even, I think, like, just a little missile tank hidden underneath the Mother Brain, like, wreckage. Like, that's just... And I don't think you can find it until, again, I think you need the power bombs to excavate it. So it's like, even if you go looking for it while in the early stages of the game, you can't get to it. But once you, if you come back way later, you can bomb under her, you know, her yeah. shell, basically, and you find something.
My husband thought that was really cool. Like, to me, that was one of the things I missed out on, because I had no idea when I first played the game. I had not really played the original Metroid either, but he was a big fan of the original game. So, like, he said he always really appreciated that sort of attention to detail.
Now, I will say that when people come up with fan hacks and custom-made Metroid sequels and that sort of thing, they really love to abuse the idea
yeah.
of super high-skill hidden objects. And sometimes they just need to pull it back a little bit. Sometimes, you know, they're like, well, what if you had to use the techniques that you employ to acquire these super hidden items as, you know, like the main path through the game? What if you had to basically play like a superhero in order to make any progress whatsoever? I guess
if you're making levels for a game, you're probably at least fairly good at it. So I guess you're mm-hmm. making stuff. Well, I mean, this is nothing like Super Metroid, but my example would be, of all things, the Chips Challenge community.
Oh, I love Chips Challenge.
Yeah, Chips Challenge is one of my favorite games. And if you download level packs that have been made by the community, you will start... They're like Mensa tier, like just impossible like puzzles. And I have no idea how anyone could possibly do any of them. It's wild stuff. It's worth seeing, honestly.
And something that kind of goes hand in hand with the idea of like these super skills is the opportunity to sequence break, which... that was a pretty new concept at the time. It wasn't totally new. Like, you know, playing the original Metroid, I would always think, like, how can I, you know, cheat and get through here before I'm supposed to? But it feels much more baked into Super Metroid. There was a great example that I read about recently, and now the details have totally slipped my mind. But there are a few places where... I know what it is. It's... In kind of Upper Brinstar, there's an area where you have to have the grappling hook to pass over a certain space. But it is possible to kind of go out of your way and skip that and skip the grappling hook by using a Shine Spark, like, dash run
yeah.
to clear that water. Like, if you do it a certain way, you have to, like, build up your charge by running, and then, you know, you press down to hold the charge and then jump and press forward as you, like, in midair. It's, you know, one of the more advanced techniques, but it is possible to clear that space and just totally bypass the grappling hook. And it doesn't actually give you any advantages. It doesn't really save time, but the person who was writing about this, and I think I might have seen it on like a Twitter thread or something. I apologize for the person who I'm not crediting here. But they pointed out the fact that this is clearly a deliberate choice by the designers. Like, they added this consciously, and you can tell because you have just enough lead up time to run and build up the Shine Spark and, complete that. Like, it's not an accident that they gave you exactly the right amount of space. So it's just one of those things where they kind of put this thing in for, you know, a little bit of a grace note. And there are other spaces where you can acquire items out of sequence. Like, I don't remember how I did it, but I am positive that I have faced Spore Spawn with a super missile, which you're not supposed to be able to get until after you beat Spore Spawn. But I clearly remember going in there one time and being like, oh, I'm just going to wreck this thing. Now, this was, you know, 30 years ago. So how did I do that? I don't know. But I definitely went in there and just like pulverized the first boss with like two shots. And it was awesome.
I was going to say, he had no idea what was coming, did he?
No, absolutely.
There are a lot of super missile pickups you can find in different little places. And I know it's kind of funny to me because, you know, as we get to later, a lot of the bosses have sort of tutorial elements to them. Like they teach you how to do this, teach you this. I think it's very funny that Spore Spawn, which is very much a, you know, practice how to aim boss because it moves very slowly and it opens up and lets you hit it. So it's like, this is a game, this is a boss teaches you how to play the game. And at this point, you almost never see the boss anymore because everyone knows an easier way to get super missiles. So they just never fight them anymore. So it's like, it's the boss you see the absolute least, you know, like even less than Krokemeyer, which I know is also could be skippable, but it's like the Spore Spawn is very rare. Like when I replayed the game and fought him, I was like, oh yeah, this thing. I had to remind myself what it was.
I want to skip the Spore Spawn. What's the worst part of the game for me? I hate that boss.
It looks like Oscar the Grouch though. It's so cute.
That's fair. I mean, I think it's fair to say also in the later games like Fusion and Zero Mission, as much as I enjoyed them, the Infusion, the sequence breaking was extremely sort of stripped back. It was very linear. But in Zero Mission, while it was present, it felt very inorganic to me. Like, to skip, like, an initial super missile skip is, there's a piece of ground that you can jump over and sort of shoot downwards through for no real reason. It's hard to explain the difference, but it's the distinction between, oh yes, we should make the player feel like a genius for figuring this out, but between like the player figuring out which blocks are inexplicably shootable, from what weird angles you can shoot them. That's not as good to me as what they did in Super Metroid, but, you know, they're all great games, I'd say.
Yeah, in later games, I think the developers kind of became aware of fan culture and the way people play patterns, and kind of accounted for sequence breaking, both by integrating opportunities in ways that are, you know, non-destructive to the critical path, but also in kind of acknowledging the fact that players would do that. I know there's a part in Metroid Fusion where you can do some ridiculous arcane shine spark, you know, travel to get out of the proper sequence. And if you do it, you go to a computer terminal and Adam's like, wow, you're not supposed to be here yet. Good job, but you can't go any further now. Sorry. So they give you a nod. They're like, well done. You did something you weren't supposed to, but sorry, this game is too gated and too linear. So we're not allowing you to go any further.
You know,
but
I
think it's nice that they at least give you the opportunity to flex a little bit.
I could be completely wrong, but I think the unknown items in Zero Mission are a nod to the sort of concept of sequence breaking. Like you find these items and like you literally cannot use them. But it's part of the game because as soon as you get them, then you can like break certain blocks or whatever. But like you don't actually use the items until way later in the game after you get the suit back. But to me, that whole concept of finding stuff you cannot use, but it's part of the game, I think that's them sort of tipping their hat like, oh, don't you feel like you've gone somewhere special now? It's like, you knew I'd come here. So it's not exactly the same thing.
It's kind of artifice. Yeah, agreed.
It's kind of creepy, though, to find those things. There's like this ominous music.
Yeah, the music's weird, too. Yeah.
I mean, it's such a great game, Zero Mission. It
really is. I put you up a piece of toxic waste, I guess, or something.
It kind of reminds me of the same feeling I got when I played Marathon for the first time. And you can pick up alien weapons, and your HUD is basically your space armor that, you know, tells you your current weapons and how much ammo you have for it. But then you go onto the alien ship and you pick up the weird flamethrowers that the aliens use, and you just get an error message. So you have no idea how much, you know, juice you have left for this weapon. They carry that over into Halo also, but it lacks the HUD. So, yeah. So it kind of misses the mystique, but yeah, like there's just the sense of, you know, like I have something that I'm not supposed to have, and that's weird, but also cool. Like I'm doing something bad. All right, so let's talk about the narrative and level design structure of Super Metroid. I touched on this earlier, talking about Meridia, but Super Metroid really is, I realize this is kind of a cliche, but it really is a masterclass in telling a story just through the adventure itself. And, you know, that, again, that concept was not new. Lots of video games said, before Super Metroid said, hey, you are traveling through a space and, you know, like the space itself tells a story. And I think that probably goes back to Ghosts and Goblins, where it gives you the little mini map and it's like, oh, you're, you know, on the castle grounds and now you're going through the forest and now there's some ruins and, oh, you went through the gate to hell and now you're in hell.
Like you did.
Yeah, nobody ever got that far.
That's right. Yeah, but it showed you the mini map at the beginning of each stage. So you were like, oh, there's hell. Yeah. I'm never going to get there.
Trojan does the same thing, but you don't go to hell.
Yeah. You go to Troy? Yeah.
Castlevania, Troy. Of course. The map of Castlevania is wonderful.
Castlevania 3's maps are just like, mwah, they're perfect.
Mm-hmm. Even Alex Kidd does it.
That's true. I'm trying to think. Like, Ghosts and Goblins was 85, and so I maybe there's something that precedes that, but I really feel like that kind of opened the floodgates for people saying, ah, yes, this is a physical space. And, you know, you even go back to like the Atari 2600 and a game like Pitfall, a lot of thought is put into the map, Pitfall 2, mm-hmm. especially, just like how these physical spaces work. But Super Metroid really, I think, took it up to the next level by not giving you like a mini map to say, you know, here are the spaces you're going to go through. Like it would give you a very abstract map to say, like, here is a space that exists, but you don't know what's here. Go figure it out. But, you know, as you travel throughout, there's just so much that you can kind of deduce from the intent, you know, about the intent of the developers and about what kind of space you're supposed to be in. And, you know, the opening and the finale of the game are, I would say, timeless. They do so much to convey a story and create stakes and even emotional stakes without saying a single word. Like Samus gives a little recap of the past two games at the beginning of the adventure. But once you actually take control of Samus and start playing, nothing else is said. It's all just wordless. It's all just looking at the environments and saying, like, what's going on here? Where do I need to go? This is cool. This is creepy. This is weird. I'm lost in the water space. What's going on? Just a lot for players to kind of determine themselves. And it's great because the game works on multiple levels. You can just approach it as like, here's a fun adventure. I'm going to go blow up space jellyfish and kill a big cyborg brain. And it's cool. But if you really, you know, want to kind of pick through, like, what is this world here? There is some really great visual world building in terms of, you know, ambiance and structures and details that, it's great stuff.
The opening alone, I think, is still pretty much unmatched, especially for a 16-bit game. By the time I had played Super Metroid, of course, I had seen, like, more than my fair share of 32 big games and beyond, but just when Samus comes out after activating that security system and everything's swarming with space pirates and the music kicks up, that's pretty damn cool.
Can I be slightly controversial and say that I wish that on replays you could skip the entire opening bit with Ridley? I just don't enjoy that anymore. Like,
I love it. I still love doing it.
Yeah. Okay. I apologize.
I always like to see if I can make Ridley drop the baby Metroid.
My husband can, but I can't.
I used to be able to, but I can't do it anymore, and that's the reason I'm cross. I don't want to be reminded of my own generation.
That's understandable. Got it. You're excused.
Yeah, I don't want to be reminded of my own degenerative like, gaming skills. I used to be, they used to say leet. But now, they call
with
me
two
cringe.
Threes?
Once I was leet, but now I am cringe.
Oh, no.
I agree, honestly. Because you just said that.
I think modders have removed the opening text crawl, at least. Because a lot of people speedrun this game. A lot of people play randomizer this game. A lot of people play randomizer this game paired with Link to the Past for the ultimate experience. And I think at this point, modders take that part out. So you can press start to skip the text bit. But they still expect you to do the opening sequence because that is challenging. Indeed, I think there's versions that actually lower the timer to make it actually hard, you know?
I'm sure there are, yeah. You know? Give me like 10 seconds.
I would like to be able to skip that text crawl. Nothing against Samus, but damn.
Yeah, I mean,
she was always talkety, I guess.
Once you know the story,
if they were to mod it so that it was just a straight line and then you walk along it and then it ends and you get like congratulated massively, that would be fine by me. I would like that.
So you want Super Passage, not Super Metroid.
Yeah, Super Passage, yeah. Yeah, except there's nothing about death or like time being said. It's just a very easy game.
Yeah, so the opening sequence, that was something that video games had done before. I think we might have touched on this, like Wonder Boy 3, you know, gives you kind of basically the final boss of the previous game as a prologue, and Symphony of the Night would do the same thing.
Yes.
But the opening sequence does a few different things. One, it gives you the timed escape sequence that Metroid 2 did not. Like, Metroid 2 has an escape sequence, but it's zero stakes. It's, you know, you found a baby, and the baby's going to clear a road for you.
There's
no timing. It's nice.
Cute.
It's a little different, but it almost feels like they start this game by saying, okay, we didn't give you this kind of adrenaline rush at the end of the last game, so here it is, opening the game now. And at the same time, it also exists as a little bit of a tech demo to kind of say, like, hey, you can expect flashier, more interesting things happening in this Metroid than in previous Metroids, you know, especially after Metroid 2, which was compromised in some ways by the nature of the Game Boy hardware. Here you get, you know, the escape sequence up the shaft, just like at the end of Metroid, the first game. But now the shaft is rotating and tilting, and
you get this whole
Mode 7 thing, and it changes the way you have to approach it, because if you jump at the wrong point, the screen will actually tilt, and you can't actually jump high enough to reach a ledge.
Ouch.
And then on top of that, you have like steam blasting, and it doesn't hurt you, but it does delay you. And so it's just, you know, these little factors that you have to deal with. And the entire time you're, you know, on the brink of death, most likely because Ridley smacked you repeatedly with his tail and brought you to critical health. So it just creates this really stressful sensation. Like, you go into this creepy kind of place full of corpses trying to figure out what's going on. Here's, you know, a big boss from the previous game. It steals your objective, beats you within an inch of your life, and then sets the place to explode. That's a really cool setup. Like, that's a step above Bombing Run from Final Fantasy VII. Like, it's hardcore. It's great.
An amazing way to introduce the game, introduce the character, introduce the world, raise the stakes, and yet it's really hard to actually die. Like, the only way to actually die is to somehow not manage to escape during the fairly generous time sequence. But, like, Ridley cannot kill you. Nothing in the station can actually hurt you once, you know, Ridley lowers you down to, you know, like, whatever, 30 life, you're beeping. But nothing else that happens in there can actually do you any damage.
Right.
So, but it is stressful, and it's beeping at you, and there's a clock ticking down. So it's like you've got your adrenaline, you've got your oh my god, I gotta get out of here feeling, but in reality, you're almost assuredly gonna make it. almost assuredly. Right.
It is nice that the object, like the quote unquote hazards in the collapsing space station, don't cause any damage, because it does reinforce the fact that, hey, it's Samus. She's in a suit of armor, and acoustic ceiling tiles, you know, those aren't going to cause her any harm unless she like breathes them and gets asbestos in her lungs.
Oh, no, a little bit of air.
A little bit of steam. Oh, gosh. Yeah. So it's a hindrance, but not a hazard, I would say. So once you complete that adrenaline rush, the game goes back to being very quiet and kind of low key. And you start to get a sense of, one, like the different areas of Planet Zebes where the adventure takes place. And we did talk about this last time about how you start by going to, you land on the planet's surface and then enter into familiar spaces from the first game in reverse by traveling through the escape route that you passed through after defeating the final boss of the first game. But then you make use of the actual geometry and the actual geography of the original Metroid, where the final boss was actually in a room directly above where you begin the game. And now there's actually an elevator that leads from that final boss space to where the first game began, which is a neat little touch.
I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. If you, as someone who has drawn out the map of Metroid several times, it is this little like, oh, you know, if I just drilled through the ceiling, I could have beaten Mother Brain right away, but nope.
Wow. There's no wonder
you're
really
into it. Behind her and punched her in the back, yeah.
No wonder you're into Etrian Odyssey.
It's good stuff, like finding all these geographic spaces. But yeah, so, you know, the opening of Super Metroid and, you know, a lot of the spaces in Brinstar and Norfair, even Crazelier, are direct reprises of spaces in the original Metroid, but, you know, built out to be more elaborate and with new connections. Like I said, you know, there's spaces in that opening area of the original Metroid where, you know, if you drop a power bomb there, you're just going to clear out entire chunks of scenery.
Yes.
That, you know, that was unthinkable in the original Metroid because you didn't have power bombs, but now you do. And you're like, wow, I'm so powerful. Oh my God, what are these giant things that are jumping into me? And I'm dead. What happened?
Yep.
I think that what you mentioned about the sort of the throwbacks to the original Metroid, there are some kind of cute gags in there, like the when you fight sort of Tiny Kraid outside of Kraid's lair.
I love Tiny Kraid.
Because he's that size more or less in the NES game.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then you're like, okay. And then, of course, you go through the door and you fight this skyscraper-sized follow-up to Kraid. And I think that's a fun little gag. I think it's a nice nod. It's something I don't think I'd seen or have seen that much subsequently, which is a game sort of acknowledging its sort of past in such a I don't even know how to describe it. It's comedy. It's
a
joke.
Is there even like a story reason for Tiny Kraid?
I mean, there was a fake Kraid. There was a fake Kraid in the first Metroid.
Right.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay.
But
so
in this version, it sort of has the double act where it's like, not it's carrying forward the concept of fake Kraid, but now it's like, it's a fake Kraid that's small, and then once you find the real Kraid, you're like, where's the other guy?
If you've not had that spoiled for you by magazines or something, which, because I imagine he was quite the screenshot looker in magazines.
Yeah. He's on the back of the box, I think.
I mean, fair enough. Well, there we go. Because, for me, this game is my initial experience of Super Metroid, as I may have mentioned, was an issue of EGM I inexplicably had that had a feature on it that had absolutely no criticism, as per usual. It was just literally I don't think there's anything wrong with that, to be able to have a magazine that is just like, oh my God, aren't games amazing? Look, every game is amazing. Look, Ardy Lightfoot is the best game I've ever seen in my entire life. And then, like, you get Super Metroid, and it's just like, holy shit, these are all the bosses, these are all the locations, this game's insane, it's 24 meg or whatever. It's like that meant something back in the day.
Yeah, I sure did.
And this game is just, it plays to that. It plays to that sense of spectacle. And I think Fake Raid is a good example of a little joke, you know, a fun little joke. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have fake, like, you have small Dragon as well, and then you get giant Dragon. And yeah. It's just...
That's less funny.
The sense that, yes, it is less funny. It's, you get to electrocute him, so that's fun.
I actually don't know how I did it. I think I beat Dragon, like, legit the first time. Like, I didn't know about the whole trick. About like
I think I knew about it because of AGM.
there you are. Yeah. Okay, you got something there.
Yeah, I have the rare experience, I guess, of having been a diehard Metroid fan, having played Metroid 2 through all the way through, and going into Super Metroid knowing nothing about it because I had not been reading magazines and it just showed up in stores and I was like, oh my god, there's another Metroid. I need to buy this immediately and play it. So I went into it really just completely unspoiled.
That
first encounter with Kraid, I beat the little Kraid and he dies in one shot. Like you hit him with something and he's gone. And I was like, this is clearly not Kraid as I know him. But then
yeah, I think
there is Kraid and he is not Kraid as you once knew him because he's a much bigger lad.
I think one super missile kills Fake Kraid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Big Kraid, not so much. You have to fire about 10 of them.
Yeah, you have to shove a few down his throat. And finally...
Yep. Mm-hmm. While he's like shooting platforms out of his belly. That's a weird evolutionary strategy.
The way you do.
So, you know, just the way the game unfolds, a lot of it is carried over from the original Metroid in terms of geography. And it's very familiar if you know the first game. But then you start going into new spaces. I mentioned this with Meridia, but, you know, even Lower Brinstar is just a completely new space and doesn't have any real correspondence to the original Metroid, like spaces in that game. And there is a change when you get there, like the music changes from the rousing, you know, classic Brinstar theme to something that has more like tuned percussion and, you know, very 90s electric bass. And, you know, it even looks different. Like, even though you're descending further into the underground, like, all of a sudden, there's, like, cherry blossoms and stuff.
Yeah, it's all plants.
It's really striking. It really is striking. I love it.
It does definitely, like, kind of break up the monotony of underground caverns.
We talked about it last episode, but this game, like... Everywhere you go, even in the same areas, you're seeing different color schemes, different ideas visually. It's a beautiful, beautiful game.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I find kind of unappealing about Hollow Knight, at least from, you know, the hour or so that I've played, is that it's always just this monochrome, bleak, like there's no visual variety really to speak of.
I disagree.
I get where you're coming from,
but it does have a lot of, I think, the different areas are all very strongly color-themed, but there is a dreariness to it. I do accept that. That game meant so much to me that I'm just very defensive of it.
I've noticed that. I'm not trying to insult it. I'm just saying, like, I don't connect with it the way that I do this game.
Like Insect Game, Jeremy, please. Thank you.
I feel... You know, other Metroidvania style games generally don't do as good a job of creating separation organically between spaces. I mean, Super Metroid does have the individual zones, Taurian and Norfair and Brinstar and so forth. But within those zones, there is a lot of visual distinction.
If we talk about lower Brinstar, you know, you enter there and it's all plants and greenery, and there's like this bunch of like thorns everywhere, but you can explore side passages and you've got that one long horizontal passage where if you try to speed run through there, you fall into the pit and you get the shine spark. That area is kind of like sandy and it leads to another big room which is almost like bright yellow, but then if you go down again you get more of the flowers again. So even in the contrast between Lower Brinstar and I guess West Brinstar, North Brinstar, regular Brinstar. Once you're inside Lower Brinstar, you still find different kinds of areas. And, you know, Norfair is the same thing. Norfair has, like, you know, it's a big lava place, sure. But some of the chambers are sort of red hot, and some of them are kind of dark brown, and some of them have actually structure to them, that and they look like someone's building something. There's that one big room that's like a giant monster face. Like, every little zone in this game seems to have its own breakdown environments within those zones, which I think is just...
Yeah.
It's awesome. It's absolutely awesome.
It's really handy to look at. And, you know, I can think of a lot of games that just do not manage that. I mean, even, you know, I'm obviously a huge fan of Castlevania Symphony of the Night, but again, because the whole game takes place inside Dracula's castle, there are distinct areas, and they do a good job of making those areas really cool, and the music helps. But once you're in those areas, you're kind of like, okay, this is the Colosseum, so we are in the Colosseum now. We are in the church. Everything's a church.
Everything's a church.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like Symphony of the Nights and, you know, subsequent Igavanias, they give you like a theme per space, and it's, you know, it's a hard separation between areas. But then there's like within those spaces, there's always kind of a central set piece. Like, you know, you go into Orlox's lair, and there's the fountain that turns to blood as you run past it in kind of like a courtyard. You know, in the marble gallery, the alchemy lab, there's, you know, the big room where you fight the first couple of bosses.
There's also the chapel has that really amazing just chapel space that they kind of use like a pseudo 3D effect for.
I feel like Symphony of the Night, as great as it is, it took me a long time to appreciate that game, but the issue for me, and it's not really the game's fault, it's a matter of the technology, the disc accessing just takes it out of me every time. You go through one of those corridors, and they even have them in the Game Boy Advance games for some reason. But it's just like, okay, that area's finished, you're now in this area, everything's changed, the music's changed. It's inorganic again, but it's not to take away from the fact that it is very obviously an incredible game. You know.
Yeah, and I feel like games that don't create hard barriers and distinctions between spaces, they tend to be kind of a chore to navigate through. Like, I'm thinking of Shadow Complex, which doesn't really have individual spaces within the big base you're exploring. Yeah. And, you know, things vary and change as you travel around. But getting around, you know, I find that game... you know, once you kind of gain a lot of traversal abilities, like, I'm constantly going toward one space, but then it routes me in a different way, and it's just not possible to get where I want to go. Strider 2014 is also really, really bad about that. And I really like that game up until the point where you have to backtrack a lot. And it's just really tedious, and, you know, you have to constantly check the map, the mini map, to see where you are, because the game doesn't really communicate especially well where you are in the space and how those spaces interconnect. And it's frustrating.
Are there any games in the genre that we haven't mentioned that you personally think do that particularly well, or even match the Super Metroid style? Because I can't think of any. I mean, my head went to Cave Story, but I barely consider that a Metroidvania because it's so linear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty linear.
Yeah, it's a great game, don't get me wrong. I just thought, like, is there anything that matches it, like, at all, really?
No, I mean, I really can't think of a game that handles its environment as well as Super Metroid. That is kind of still the gold standard.
Like, even the subsequent Metroids, like Metroid Dread even, like, it's just not as good. Well, and it's a shame.
You can point out, you know, if we want to actually point out something that I think is slightly disappointed about Super Metroid, is the fact that, you know, Metroid and Metroid 2, they have similar concepts, but they are very different. Like, they literally take place on different planets. So the one downside to Super Metroid is the fact that because you're going back to Zebes, and because you fight Kraid again, you fight Ridley again, you fight Mother Braid again, there's this unfortunate habit where it's like so many subsequent Metroid games just... you do the same thing again. Like, how many times has Ridley come back? How many times has Kraid come back? You know, like, in Zero Mission, at least the idea was we're redoing the first game.
But yeah, it's like, for sure.
There are lots of other games that are not, you know, remakes that Kraid and Ridley just show up in. It's like, well, why are they here again? Why is everyone back again? You know, it's kind of like the Street Fighter 2 prop. You know, once Capcom hit the big Street Fighter 2, somehow every subsequent Street Fighter has to be Street Fighter 2 now because, you know, they're too scared to make another Street Fighter 3
for a while.
Yeah, you know, I think I can forgive them for reprising familiar bosses in this one because one, they're not the only bosses you face.
Yes,
and two, both of them are kind of do-overs of the first game, where the bosses in the original Metroid, they're not actually good. Like, Ridley just jumps up and down, and he spits fireballs at you. And in the Japanese version, the fireballs were kind of challenging because they were randomized. But in the American version, they screwed up somehow, and his fireballs all travel one of two arcs that resets depending on when you enter the room. And so you can literally just, like, stand beneath the arc of his fireball and pepper him with missiles. Like, that's not interesting. So they make Kraid really big, and they give Ridley the ability to fly around, give him a physical attack in addition to fireballs, and just makes it much more challenging. So that's cool. And, you know, I don't even mind, like, Metroid Fusion doesn't bring back Kraid, but it does bring back Ridley just as, like, hey, we froze his corpse, and we're going to do experiments on it.
That's a great moment. That's
we are embraced by our own petard because now the ex-parasite has taken over Ridley's corpse and is like double dangerous. God,
I love Metroid Fusion so much.
That was fun. That was a cool fight.
My favorite Ridley fight is in Zero Mission because it's actually garbage. You can just stand there and spam him with missiles. But the way that he's introduced is you run across a room and you get a power up, you turn around and come back. And then when you go back into the room and turn around, there's suddenly a jump scare.
Yeah.
It's a cutscene of Ridley flying towards your face. And that I forgive everything about how bad the fight is because of that and how cool Ridley's sprite is. It's just really, really cool, and that's all that matters to me.
I agree.
I'm
all about the cool.
Yeah, one thing I appreciate about the fact that the map is set up the way it is that it really kind of turns Criteria into a hub. It gives you like a home base, which none of the other Metroid games had. I mean, the original Metroid, you always start at, you know, that twin rock formation, unless you've saved in a got a password in a different space. And in the Japanese version, no matter where you saved, you always started back at the twin rock hub. Metroid 2 gives you Samus's ship, and you can return to it at any point and recharge your health. But once you get a certain way into the game and really start facing the Alpha Metroids, why would you want to go back all the way to her ship just to like save? There are save stations throughout the game, so it doesn't feel like a base. It's just like the starting point where you can go back and save in the very beginning. But in Super Metroid, you constantly kind of get routed back through Criteria and Upper Brinstar. And so it really does feel like every time you come back there, you see Samus's ship and you're like, oh, okay, familiar territory. Mm. But then you branch off in different directions. You know, there's like the really high area of Brinstar. There is the pirate ship. There's the passage to Meridia. And that's, you know, in addition to the initial descent into Brinstar. So you go back there multiple times, and then, you know, that's where the game ends also when you escape from the planet.
Yeah.
So it feels like, even though this is a big rambling space, there's so much to explore, so many dangers out there, you always have this kind of sense of, you know, like a home base. And that's something that video games weirdly don't do that often. Like, you know, I was struck when Final Fantasy VIII gave you the garden as kind of like a home base for your characters, which eventually can, you know, it's a school that flies around the world. Why not? But, you know, it just the fact that, like, here's kind of a safe, familiar space. It's weirdly uncommon in video games and is something that, you know, I think is a nice touch.
I'm trying to think of other games that managed to pull it off, but then I start thinking about the fast travel problem, which we haven't really talked about, but, you know, Metroid games don't really do fast travel.
I don't think any of them have it at all. Maybe the Prime ones, I don't know.
But
that's the whole complaint about the Icon Hunt or whatever it is.
I never played Metroid Prime, and then I finally got a remastered version. I was like, finally, I'm going to play it, and I haven't played it.
Nice. But yeah, I do think it's the fact that the map is built around this one area and branching from it. I also like the fact that whenever you restart the game after a save, you get that sort of world map view. Like, you know, it's not the grid. It's just kind of like this sort of like hexagon sort of overview of like, here are all the zones.
Like a real generalized.
Yeah, that's map. It looks amazing as well. It looks really, really cool and futuristic.
It doesn't, kind of 3D-ish.
It doesn't give you that much information as far as like what connects to what, but it just kind of shows you. You got a lot, you know, especially if you've going back to it for maybe the first time after playing for maybe an hour or two, you go back, it's like, oh, wow, there's a lot more to this game than I expected, you know, because it highlights those extra zones. Actually, I wanted to highlight that. I mentioned I was watching a live streamer today play this game. He really hit upon it. It's like, yeah, this game does a great job of making you feel like you're on an alien planet. You know, this is a person who would definitely... I don't know. He might have been a 30-something person. He might be alive when this game first came out, but he was blown away by the graphics and presentation and just overall world building and what's on display here. Like, he was just like, man, this game looks incredible, and I do feel like I'm exploring an underground world. And yeah, I get lost, but guess what? If I was actually doing this, I'd probably get lost too.
So. I'd be dead in 5 seconds.
Pretty much. The first small thing that crawls towards you, that probably the zoomer, that'd be my end right there.
I'd get to the gap in the wall and I'd be like, why can't I crawl? And then I would just lie down on the ground.
And you'd starve to death.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that each of the areas, you know, a lot of the zones have kind of subspaces within them, but also each area kind of has its own personality. You know, like we talked about how Meridia is kind of big, open, rambling, has a lot of confusing dead-end passages. Brinstar is very sort of a guided experience until you get to the lower section and there's a more exploration. Norfair is very much, you know, it has like the central shaft and then lots of branches from there. And it's almost like a puzzle to figure out where can I go now without burning myself to a crisp.
Mm-hmm.
You get to the pirate ship and it's a very, very small space, but it's so dense and you have to kind of explore it twice because once you're passing through it and it doesn't have any power, so it's just inert, and you're facing like space ghosts, but not the talk show kind. Just like the kind that haunts you. Yeah,
kind of just pop up randomly.
They're slimy.
Something I love about the pirates.
Space pirates do look like Zorak, though.
True, they actually do. My word. One thing that I love about the pirate ship on the first visit, and maybe this is exclusive to me, but that's the place that I think you're initially most likely to get stuck, because I think the way that you proceed from there is actually quite obtuse in a way. Mm. Once you realize it, once you know, oh, you bomb this cracked floor. It's not, when I say it like that, it sounds incredibly obvious, but it's not the kind of cracked floor you've seen before. So it also kind of teaches you to pay attention to innocuous parts of the environment.
Like
on my most recent playthrough, I got stuck there because I'd completely forgotten how to progress. And when I figured it out, I was like, I'm not mad because it's actually, when you know, you're like, oh yeah, of course, the floor has a huge crack in it.
I'm just disappointed in myself for not seeing
exactly.
That.
But I think it's good. I do like that. It's just a tiny little area and you're just like, how the hell am I supposed to move forward from here?
I like how we've been going through the doors in and out, no problem in Metroid by this point in the game. And you get to the ship and everything's locked and they kind of use that gameplay blockage as like, this is because there's no power to the ship, so the doors don't work. And you're like, that makes a lot of sense, even though it's something we did not worry about at all within the main game itself. But now all of a sudden, this is actually pretty creepy and interesting.
You know, one story beat about that, which actually makes this area pretty challenging if it's your first playthrough, the save point doesn't work. You can find a save point. It doesn't work. There's no power.
Map, same thing.
Yeah. Once you kill the Fantoon and you show the power, then everything comes back on. But yeah, that's actually a sticking point because if I don't know how close the nearest save point is, you know, if Fantoon kills you, and he might, because he probably will. Yeah. You might
try to hit him with super missiles and you're in trouble. Yeah.
Yeah.
The pirate ship is great also because I feel like Metroid Zero Mission tried to retcon the pirate ship or the ghost ship into being the pirate's vessel that you caused to crash. But the visuals and the overall vibe is that this ship is an ancient wreck. Yeah. And there's a lot of story that plays out through this one zone because, you know, visually, it's very retro inside. Once you activate the robots, they look like Robbie the Robot, you know, from Lost in Space.
Exactly.
And the little floating guys are kind of like a Sputnik sort of, you know, retro satellite. But, you know, you activate the power and the monitors come on in the background and you see like these flashes of Metroids. So it suggests like, you know, this was man or alien species' own hubris. Like they captured Metroids from SR-366 or whatever and were transporting them, and they crashed here. And that's why Metroids ended up on planet Zebes, because there was an accident in space.
I didn't even know that. And
the security system caught were Metroids, and then they escaped somewhere into Zebes. I mean, that's not explicitly stated, but I think that's a very valid reading that it leads to.
It's very
just
implied.
Looking at the details. Yeah. Like, you know, if you go back and read the original Metroid manual, they discovered Metroids on Zebes and the space pirates were trying to cultivate them. So where do they come from? Because, you know, their home planet was something totally different. And, you know, clearly Metroids don't build their own spaceships. So what's the deal? So it's a cool little feature of world building that has kind of been retconned out by the original Metroids remake. But I like this reading of it.
And yeah, that's pretty cool.
Diamond, you mentioned in the notes that given that it's submerged and the boss is a literal ghost, it seems to be an ancient wreck.
Yeah, I also was really surprised in researching my little joke at the start of the show. I looked up Zebetites, and the wiki says there are Zebetites on the ancient ship, which I think is a really cool touch. I never noticed that before. But that makes, I mean, it would make sense that just in the wall somewhere or in those panels, you could use that graphic again. It would just make sense. And it was like, oh, well, maybe these things made the Zebetites. Maybe this is where the Zebetites came from. Or maybe Zebetites are just a standard, like, USB port in this alien world, you know?
Yeah, it's like Voyager's, Star Trek Voyager's, what is it? The
gel packs?
The organic tech? Yes, the gel packs, the biomed gel packs. Yeah, exactly. They got rid of EPS conduits. Now it's Zebetites.
What? Yeah. What is this? What's happening?
Don't feed it cheese.
Don't worry about it.
Gel packs? Oh, God.
Yeah, I don't watch Star Trek of any kind, so.
Yeah, I watch cool TV shows like Samurai Pizza Cats and X-Files.
Samurai Pizza Cats.
They're so good. So good.
Stuart, you were mentioning how easy it is to get kind of stuck in the ghost ship.
Well, I think only specifically on the very first time that you step into even a bit of it, which is very early in the game.
Like there's, you know, the game is constantly kind of like throwing new navigational puzzles at you.
Another
spot that you can really easily get stuck is acquiring the gravity suit, if I'm not mistaken, where it requires some observation and you saying like, oh, here is a thing that is different from everything else that I've seen that resembles this. What does that mean? And it's a Chozo statue that's holding nothing, because normally they hold little balls. Yeah, it's so you might not think anything of it, like, oh, I don't get an item here. But then you're supposed to kind of make the connection like, wait, normally they're holding balls and Samus can roll into a ball. What happens if Samus rolls into a ball and becomes the item and that unlocks a door? Which I think I got stuck with that one for a while back the first time I played.
My husband says, like, he figured that out right away. And I said, how? And he said, well, when you play the original Metroid, like, who doesn't pretend they're the ball sometimes?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it even reforms. The little thing forms over you. You disappear. It's kind of a fun little,
and of course, Zero Mission made that into its whole navigation system, basically just constantly doing that.
Yeah, I played this game before I had access to strategy guides, so I would have figured that out on my own. But I guess I was just more clever than I am now. Back then, 30 years ago, 30 years of strain on the old gray matter.
I mean, an interesting thing for me that's repeated throughout the game to some extent is, again, we may have mentioned this, so I do apologize if I'm repeating the same beats here, but the entire area where before you get the ice beam, you are essentially locked into a mini Metroidvania of its own, because there is no way to get back, to get out into the main major game again until you get that ice beam. So it's just this, some fairly small, but like plenty, you know, probably about 100 different rooms or something. Mm-hmm. This area where you're trying to figure out, like, how the hell do I get back out of here? I mean, seeing the enemies, you could maybe make an informed guess that you'd eventually be using them as platforms in some way. But it is just essentially a bucket that you're trapped in until you can figure out a way out. And I kind of like that. It makes it all feel a bit... So when you get stuck, it's like you know there's got to be something nearby. There has to be, because there's nowhere else you can go.
Yeah, that's one where Metroid veterans definitely had the advantage, because the actual manual to the original Metroid explicitly tells you how to freeze enemies with the ice beam
and use them
as platforms. Like, there's a little drawing of little chubby Samus shooting a cute little beam at a cute little enemy. You know,
a cute little beam for a cute little guy.
Yeah, it's just a little...
I just wanted to do an obtuse Akewood reference, and thanks for that, listeners. I'll be back with more of that soon.
So that's something that, you know, if you have played Metroid before, it gives you kind of the advantage there. But I do want to talk about, kind of as our final stop on this journey, the different weapons and items and upgrades that Samus gets. Because again, you know, a big thing that makes Metroid unique is that everything you acquire has a dual purpose, and you don't really acquire explicit keys. You just make Samus stronger, and by giving her new weapons and abilities, she gains the power to explore more of space. So there's like this kind of dual progression happening. But the weapons and tools you acquire here, there are many more of them than in previous Metroid games, mm-hmm. and you have a lot more flexibility with them. In the first two Metroid games, there were different beam upgrades, but each one overwrote the last one. So you could only hold one kind of special weapon at a time, but here they all overlap, and only the hyper beam, which is, you know, story based and doesn't really count, erases the others. So you can mix and match, which is really fun. And you may not realize it unless you start messing around in the menu. And why would you do that? But you have the ability to swap and upgrade. But having the ability to combine the ice beam and the wave beam at once was revelatory, because you had to do one or the other in the original Metroid. And in my opinion, the wave beam is actually way more practical than the ice beam, because it can just tear through stuff and it doesn't make you shoot things twice as many times.
Yeah, exactly.
But you cannot. You have to be really damn good to make it through the final zone and all those Metroids with the wave beam, because the only way you can defeat them is to freeze them and then shoot them with five missiles. And if you try to fend them off with the wave beam, that's a tough.
Does it do anything? Does the wave beam, like, at least knock them back?
I don't believe so. I think it just passes through them and makes a little noise.
I'm a jellyfish. What are you doing, you idiot?
Yeah,
that's one of the interesting things, is because you can merge all the beams and different things. You know, the ice beam in the original Metroid was a kind of a piddling little weapon. You shoot this tiny little pellet, and it kind of made the end sequence really a little terrifying, because the Metroids come from every angle, and you only really have one chance to freeze them before they grab you. Whereas this time around, if you've done your homework, if you've gotten a bunch of beams, you can shoot the ice beam through the walls. So it's like the Metroid will never come near you. Like, I don't think.
No, this game really diminishes the Metroids until you meet the titular. Until you meet the Metroid for whom the game is named, the Super Metroid, at which point you're like, oh, I'm overmatched.
Yeah. Can't shoot that.
Nope. You can, but it laughs at you.
Don't shoot your child.
But I also appreciate the fact that every sub-weapon, missiles and bombs, now has an upgrade that is much more powerful and capable of doing more stuff. I appreciate the fact that they got rid of the most superfluous and annoying upgrade from Metroid 2, the spider ball, and replaced it with nothing, because crawling around every inch of the screen is kind of annoying and slow.
At half speed, no less.
If it was faster, it would be the best thing ever.
I love it in Prime.
But, you know, the weapons and upgrades you get all kind of tie into the symbology of the environment, you know, like the colored doors for different weapons that open them. But also if you use like a power bomb or the X-ray visor, you'll see icons on various walls.
Yes.
And passages that indicate like you can get through here with a speed booster or the power bomb or whatever, which, you know, that's not very organic, but I kind of assume that that is like Samus's suit. You know, you can read it as her suit, like the computer overlay saying, hey, guess what? Here's a bomb wall.
Yeah.
But again, this is something that's been replicated extensively in other games. I mean, my go-to for this is always Guacamelee, which is just like straight up same color coding and everything.
Yeah,
and the abilities you gain are very different than those from Metroid. They tend to be more like wrestling moves and stuff. Suplexes. Samus can do that.
The subject of this week in Retro, is that right, Fain?
I discovered it last week because it just turned 10 recently as it's recording. At least the good thing about that game, one of the good things about that game, it's a very good game, is that almost all those moves you learn in Guacamelee are motion based. So it's not just you learn a move that breaks open blocks. You learn an uppercut that lets you get more air. You learn a dashing move that lets you cover more ground horizontally. You learn a, you know, ground slam that lets you go down through lots of objects or through lots of enemies if they're beneath you. So I do love. I love it when, you know, and Super Metroid is also good with this. I love it when you get a special thing that also helps your mobility. I think the really good Mega Man games do that too, where you get an item it's not just a weapon. It also lets you move faster or lets you, you know, jump on something. Or
chill, penguin, baby.
Yeah.
Shotgun ice.
And a lot of the Super Metroid stuff does that, you know, especially with the space jump and then the screw attack together. It just means like, okay, well, I don't need to land ever again. I'm just going to roll my way through this whole world now.
Yeah, so I don't want to belabor the point. I think we've, you know, covered the game pretty extensively and in some cases double covered it between this episode and last. But I don't know. Do we feel like we've fulfilled our mission here of talking about Super Metroid and talking about its connections and influence on subsequent games? Are there more games you would like to call out? Maybe like, you know, a game that channels the spirit of Super Metroid to the best possible potential in your heart?
To me, let's
wrap with that question.
To me, it's like, I don't know. To me, they're just like the top two Metroid. Sorry, that and Symphony of the Night are like the top two Metroidvanias ever made.
Just to be my willfully obtuse self, there is a PlayStation 1 game named The Divide: Enemies Within, which is a pointed Metroid-like clone because. Mm-hmm. It's sort of semi-3D. I don't think it's a great game or anything, but I do think it's a fascinating one. I think people should check it out. If you like Super Metroid, do have a look at it, because it's an attempt to create that kind of ongoing exploration kind of thing. That kind of ambience and environments are quite similar. But it's not like amazing.
No,
I don't think I've heard of it, to be honest.
It's very rough.
Yeah.
But it's one of the very, very few Metroidvania games from the late 80s or 90s. There weren't that many. The whole thing, I guess everyone kind of moved into 3D. And so you did get, you know, things like Legacy of Kain: Soul Reaver, where it's basically the Metroidvania in 3D. But that's just an entirely different prospect than a 2D Metroidvania. Like you have that third dimension and it just becomes something different. But, you know, Soul Reaver, I think, did carry forward a lot of the concepts of progression and environmental navigation as Super Metroid, just in a different way.
As you alluded to, I mean, it really did take the indies kind of revolution or the indie movement to bring this genre back, because I'm thinking about PlayStation and PlayStation 2, those eras. I'm trying to think of commercial games that fit into this template reasonably.
There are very few.
It's not many.
PS2, unless it was a reissue of something, well, you know, like Sega Ages. Well, PS2, I mean, the 3D Castlevanias were kind of like
it takes indies to bring it back, I'd say.
Yeah, in terms of the classic 2D Metroidvania, I can't think of any on Sega Saturn, that, no, shockingly like, enough. And PS2, no. GameCube, you had like Mega Man NT.
That was
kind of weird, like semi-RPG-ish kind of action platformer.
Yeah. What a game. What a stupid game. Sorry, go on.
I feel like we didn't really see anything for a very long time. Like, I remember
Shadow
Complex.
Except on portable systems.
But Shadow Complex was a big deal because that was a game that came out that was a Metroidvania. And it was like, I think you and I were probably starving to death by that point, Parrish. So, yeah, we kept an eye on that.
It's funny because I think I mentioned this last episode. I was actually very disappointed by Shadow Complex because it so literally copies everything from Super Metroid.
Yeah.
But I went back to it a couple of years ago and like the politics and narrative are... The game itself, aside from the kind of late game traversal issues, is actually really good. Now that Super Metroid has become a genre unto itself, I'm a little more forgiving. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, everyone ripped off Super Metroid. So it's not just that they were being uncreative. It's just, this is just how you do that kind
Nobody
of
else was doing it. So they were kind of one of the first.
To me, it's very funny that there was ever a time when a game being a Metroidvania was remarkable.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I mean, like, I started the whole thing of like writing about Metroidvania games in like 2005, 2006, just because I was like, hey, here's a bygone idea that, you know, aside from some portable games, is pretty much extinct. It's so sad because it's such a cool idea. Yeah. And then, you know, like 3 or 4 years later, all of a sudden people were like, ah, yes, Jeremy Parrish is correct. Let's give him an entire genre.
You can track this. You've got, other than the GBA and DS Castlevanias, which were basically it, then you got, of course, Cave Story, and then you got, like, Axiom Verge, which is just Super Metroid, basically.
Right, right.
You had, like, the Shantae games.
Yeah, but the Shantae were they Metroidvanias, though, the Shantae games? Really?
Ish, yeah. They definitely have that.
I never played the first one very much, but definitely the ones after that were.
The first one is
actually more open-ended. It's just kind of annoying to travel because of the hit values for enemies and stuff like that. But you also had Shaman King. That was also by Konami, and that was very...
Oh, man, that game was weird. Sorry, I forgot all about that. Yeah,
the Mega Man Zero and ZX games. Mm. You know, there were lots of handheld games. Monster... Oh, God, what was that called?
I know what you mean. It's like Monster... something. I know the exact one you mean. It had like a juggling combat system, and it was made by Henry.
Anyway, there were games coming out that kind of channeled the spirit besides Castlevania and Metroid, but just not a lot. Yeah, it was really Cave Story and then Shadow Complex that kicked it off. And I think once Shadow Complex hit, and it was, you know, it was a high profile game. It was 2.5D. In, you know, the Unreal Engine. So it looked pretty good. It had the ragdoll physics that everyone demands and cover-based shooting. So very of its time, but also very like 1994 because it literally was just Super Metroid. But it had Epic's name behind it. It had Chair's name behind it. So, you know, it was highly visible and big. And I think that was the point at which everyone was like, oh, we could do one of these too. And then, you know, Kickstarter debuted pretty soon after that.
Yeah.
And people were like, ah, finally, I can ask people to give me money to make a game instead of making a game and then watch it not sell.
Wasn't Hollow Knight? Hollow Knight was a Kickstarter, wasn't it? Am I wrong about that?
Yeah.
Well, it must be one of the more successful ones. The game was Monster Tail, by the way.
Monster Tail, that's it, yes.
Don't play it, though. It's terrible. Wait,
which tail? Tail with the...
A tail, like a story. They couldn't even be creative enough to... Yeah. They were going to do like a DX version. It was like previewed and it never came out.
I'm guessing you're not talking about Solo to a Robo, which was
no, that was cool.
Tale
that was cool. Yeah, that was a cool game.
That wasn't really a...
No, that's more of a Legends clone, which by God, we need more of those, but anyway.
Oh, hell yeah, and a new Legends.
Oh,
get him off the moon!
Get him off the moon,
goddamn. Something's horribly wrong with my websites. Metroidvania.com no longer resolves to Metroidvania.com, so the list that I put together is no longer there.
Aw.
Oh, well, it was like 7 or 8 years out of date anyway.
A list of Metroidvanias these days would be the size of the Bible. So
yeah, I had to give up after a while. It was just, you know, Teddy's Quest or whatever, just stuff like that was coming out. I was like, this is okay, but I'm not feeling it anymore.
I think there is mileage to do an episode following this up that is just about Metroidvanias and not necessarily Super Metroid, but that's kind of not the point.
Yeah.
Sure. So that could be interesting.
Anyway, that's Super Metroid for you. Any final thoughts? But you didn't actually, I think, weigh in on the final thoughts there. Actually, well, maybe it was just Nadia.
I was thinking one aspect of Metroid, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. We all love Samus Aran, but Samus Aran is a very specific character. And one thing that's great about, you know, the Castlevanias and other games like that is once you beat the game, you get to play the game as someone else.
Mm-hmm.
That's different. And I don't think there's ever really been or probably ever will be a Metroid game that's like, oh, you beat the game with our main character. Here's a different character for you to use. You know,
it's usually hard mode and all nothing, isn't it?
Right.
Mm. Play as Houston.
I mean, the original had, you know, had
Justin Bailey.
Yeah, exactly. The suitless Samus, yeah. But still, it's like.
But
it's
only in the American
Samus.
Version and European version, not on
Famicom. Oh, I didn't know it was not in Japan. Oh, that's right. You saved in the Japanese version, didn't you?
That's a shame.
Yep. Well, I mean, you don't have to input a password to get suitless Samus. You just have to beat the game in like less than 2 hours, and then you will start a new game as suitless Samus.
Or that's Samus, right.
Or whatever.
Yes.
But yeah, the Famicom version did not have that, so they added.
I guess my follow-up question would be: what the hell character would you play as if it wasn't Samus? Like, what the characters are there in the series? Even Etacoon.
Give it a gun.
You could play as a Metroid.
one of those guys from Other M, which you'll note we haven't mentioned because we're good people.
Oh yeah, Anthony or whatever his name was.
Yeah, you don't remember him? Oh my god. He's going to be disappointed.
How can you not forget? Remember me? No, I don't know who you are.
Could be a pirate mode. You play pirate mode?
That'd be fun.
I think a Metroid mode would be fun. Just play as a Metroid, suck a lot out of everything. It kind of reminds me of the Sisters mode in Portrait of Ruin.
I liked that. Like, that was fun.
That was super fun.
In Dawn of Sorrow, I had Julius mode, and that kicked ass because the final boss was Soma as when he fully succumbed to being Dracula.
I mean, it's basically playing that game as Castlevania 3 because you also could be as Alucard or Sypha or Yoko.
I've got a pitch. Okay. Super Metroid, except you play as Ridley and all the blocks are destructible, all of them.
so he just
bashes
right to the
his way through the maps and roaring and destroying. Now, that would be fun, I think.
That would be pretty cool. It's always fun to play as a dragon. And
yeah,
Ridley's
absolutely.
Effectively a dragon.
Ridley is sick. I love him.
All right. So that's Super Metroid. Thanks, everyone, for bearing with us for two self-indulgent episodes. And we will, I think, talk about the evolution of Metroidvania games at some point, because there's clearly the 5 minutes that we gave it here is not enough. Not enough. So we got to talk about how that goes. And since I'm not making those videos anymore, someone's got to say something about it. Actually, we could probably just distill those videos that I have made into a podcast, but that seems like cheating. So let's do it. Anyway, thanks everyone for your time. This is a patron exclusive episode, so we don't need to give you further information on how to listen to this episode. We did that at the beginning if you were just listening to the preview, but otherwise, thank you for your support. You have made rambling, self-indulgent conversations like this possible thanks to the money that you give Metroid. Retronauts, yes.
Metronauts.
Anyway, I've been Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on the internet doing all kinds of stuff, including here at Retronauts, Limited Run Games, on my YouTube channel, and so on and so forth. Go buy my books. Thank you. Nadia.
Hi, I am actually Nadia Oxford, co-host of the Acts of Blood God podcast. We talk about RPGs, old and new, Eastern and Western. We have a whole bunch of specials. We have a whole bunch of cool things in our podcast. I also do twice a month Charlene Dropout, which is a Final Fantasy XIV podcast. In addition, I also do Retronauts approximately once a month. And my last episode, which was up quite recently, was... What the hell was my last episode?
World of Power.
Thank you. That was a fun episode, for sure. That was all about the books that we read instead of... well, when you couldn't afford a video game, you bought the book. And that was the best you could do sometimes.
Faito.
Yes, hello. You can find me around the internet using the magic word F-E-I-T. That's my last name. C-L-U-B, that's a regular English word, really not magic at all. But if you look for that, and also please, because you're all patrons, don't forget we have a new monthly show where we talk to you, the community, and we read stuff that you've written to us, and we pose questions to you, and we read your feedback, and it's a lot of fun. We kind of hang out, and we talk about whatever we're doing. So
I like
it. Be sure to tune in for that one. Yeah, Stu, I've heard Stu enjoys it. So please join us for this month in Retronauts every month, as well as my weekly shows. Yeah, I'm working hard. Talk to me.
Sure.
All right. And finally, Stuart.
Hello, I'm Surjit, and I'm always doing 10 million things. I just did an episode about South Park with Bob and Henry that just dropped. The What a Cartoon lads came on to talk about South Park with me, and that was fun. I'm bringing some, I would guess, British anarchy flavor to some of this podcast. I've been getting some complaints for talking about SodaStream too much, which I will stop doing. I promise. You can find me on Twitter at Stupacabra, but, you know, tread carefully because I talk so much shite on there. And I also do... that's it. That's it. I'm not going to plug the comic this time. Thank you very much.
All right. This has been our Super Metroid journey. It looks like our time on this was 3 hours, 35 minutes, and about, looking at the notes, 87% completion. Not bad, but we're going to have to do it again. So please look forward to it.
See you next mission.